Hello and welcome to the latest in our series of Nosbrig podcasts. My name's Helga McFarlane, and people like me with Parkinson's disease tend to rely entirely on medication, often quite a cocktail of it, just to get through our everyday lives and keep moving. So this week we thought we would have a look at the pharmaceutical industry, which alone in the UK employs around 70,000 people and has an annual turnover in excess of £40 billion.
So thank you for that introduction, Helga. So this week we're delighted and honoured to have with us Alan Main, who hails from Aberdeen, so another great person from the North East, who has had a 30-year career working in a multinational, in many multinational healthcare companies, which has taken him globally all around the world to explore looking at pharmaceutical development. So really been all stages of the healthcare profession and ending up really at the top of the industry. So his work is focused mainly on consumer healthcare and medical technology, and he's the former global president of Biomedical Care and the head of customer consumer healthcare at Sanofi, and both of which are large pharmaceutical businesses. So he is now gladly retired and taking a slightly slower pace of life, but we've managed to bring him in here today to talk about and really learn from his broad experience, as he's still very much involved in the pharma industry. He's been a member of the board of a Danish pharmaceutical company, amongst many other business industries. So not quite retired, still keeping an active interest in the pharma industry, which I'm sure as many of us with COVID-19 have all had a massive interest in how the pharma industry has responded in the recent pandemic. So thank you very much for joining us this afternoon, Alan.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. So as with all the other pods, the questions have been generated from the Parkinson's community, and I suppose this will come as no surprise in relation to the first question. So one of the things that people in the Parkinson's community get frustrated about is waiting for these medications to come to fruition. It seems to take a long time from, you know, product inception till it actually comes to something that their consultants can prescribe. So in fact, some of the leading pharmaceutical companies estimate from journey from a molecule to medicine can take up to 12 years. Can you maybe just take us through the research and development journey that explains why it takes so long?
Yes, indeed. It does seem like a very long time. A 10 to 12 years is sort of an average lifetime from the initial discovery of a new chemical entity to actually finally launching the product on the market. But it's because there's a number of different stages that chemical molecule has to go through in order to ensure, first of all, that it's effective in terms of what it promises to do for the patient, but also that it's safe to use, that it doesn't have side effects, it doesn't have interactions with other drugs. So the normal pathway would you start in a pharmaceutical company with the research organization. So R&D, or research and development, the R part is the research part, and that's the early stage of discovering new medicines. And there are various ways of doing that. I don't want to go into all of the detail of that, but they screen, you know, thousands and thousands of compounds looking for ones that could have the potential to be of interest in a particular disease type. So once you've found your target, you then have to set that up and make sure that you understand the profile of that particular chemical. So a lot of that early work is done in the lab. So it's done, you know, with machines and artificially. But eventually you have to start to test that product in human beings. So then you put it into... there are three phases of clinical trial. The first phase one is in a small group of people, and that's usually just to try and work out the right dosing to make sure safety profile is good enough to continue on. Then you go into phase two trials, which are a little bit broader with more people involved. That gives you a sense again of the efficacy and the safety profile. And then finally, you would go into large phase three clinical trial programs where you often have thousands of patients involved in those trials. And one of those trials alone could cost $200-300 million just in themselves. And these trial programs have to run sequentially. They can't be run in parallel. And they, as I say, can last for 3 to 5 years, each study phase, with all of the analysis of the data that you have to do afterwards. So it can take a long time. And of course, it's also quite expensive. So not just 10 to 12 years, it also costs around $1 billion per new chemical entity that is launched. And of course, you have to remember that not all of those will make it through that full cycle to become a successful launch product. There are many that fail after phase one and phase two. And you can imagine if a product fails in phase three, after you've spent most of that money, it becomes very challenging from a financial point of view, hence the risk profile of the pharmaceutical industry.
So what do you see are some of the challenges and risks associated with drug development that perhaps, again, makes it even harder for companies to bring drugs to market?
Yes, well, I think, first of all, at the early stages, you don't know how that chemical is going to interact and whether there's any side effects that are likely to be generated. The other thing is, particularly in more complex diseases where patients are often on a cocktail of drugs, as Helga mentioned, that potentially that new chemical can also interact with the other medicines that somebody's taken. And that can cause, you know, significant negative effects as well. And sometimes you don't see that in when you've tested it just in a small group of patients. So that's why you have to have these always growing numbers of patients in the different phases of the trial program. So that's quite challenging. You want to try to screen as much of that out in the lab before you actually get it into humans. You obviously don't want to cause harm if you can possibly avoid it. So that's the main element in the research phase, moving it from research into development. I think the other thing is that actually accessing patients and actually finding the patients, particularly when you're talking about rare diseases or diseases where you have, you know, a smaller population, it's much harder to find them. And that's where you have to rely then on collaborations, particularly public-private collaborations, where you work with different healthcare institutions to try to track down and find patients to put onto your trial program. Because, of course, not every patient is willing to go into an experimental clinical trial program, for example.
And that's really interesting, because part of the purposes of these podcasts is to really increase people with Parkinson's awareness of the research process and try to get more people who could feel that they were more enabled and confident to participate in research. So it's really helpful having this insight into what happens along these stages, because I think there is a bit of fear, particularly about taking part in research. And it's also nice to hear that, you know, people with Parkinson's can participate at all different stages of the research process as well.
Yes, absolutely. And I think it's also important to state that it's a highly regulated approach. So even at the lab level, before you even go into human research, there's protocols, there's regulatory approvals that you have to get. A protocol for a clinical trial will have to go to an external committee to be approved. The regulator has to approve that in many countries. So the whole process is public, of course. You also have to publish a lot of this. And that's the other challenge for the pharmaceutical industry, because often from a competitive point of view, you have to show your competition what you're working on very early on in the life cycle of that product. And of course, as I mentioned, not all of them always make it. And of course, the other challenge is that your patent life starts from when you register that new chemical entity. And if it takes you 10 years to develop a new product, you only have 20 years in your patent life. So you've used half of that already. And that's why new drugs these days tend to have very high price tickets on them, because you have to make back that $1 billion plus some profit for your investors before your patent expires. Because when that happens, generic companies can come in and make copies of your chemical and charge much less money, and you lose about 80% of your sales pretty much overnight in the patent expiry phase of a drug.
Wow. I have to say, I didn't know that. That's really interesting. And so hence the reason generic companies can come in, because they haven't had all the R&D to do up front.
That's
so all
right.
They're doing is essentially making it now that you've concocted the effective recipe. Oh, wow.
Yes, exactly right. But in a way, it's also created, I think, for the industry, a need to focus on innovation. because if you're not innovating, you will eventually lose a big chunk of your business. So it does, in a way, force the industry to be more innovative and look for these solutions as early as possible. And that's why the industry has to spend up to 20%, sometimes 25% of its revenue on research and development to fill their pipeline of new products. It's an interesting industry because you really have to be able to look quite far into the future. Of course, there are special circumstances like COVID where you didn't have that amount of time. And there we were able to truncate the approval process very rapidly. But also because some of the candidates that were used had already been quite well researched in other conditions. So I know, for example, that some of the vaccines that were developed during the COVID crisis were originally SARS-CoV vaccine candidates. And of course, because SARS never really became the global challenge that it was feared, most of that research just went on the shelf. So they were able to bring some of that back. There was also some new technology that was worked on, mRNA, for example, and it was really a great test bed for mRNA, but fortunately it worked. If it hadn't worked, it would have been a little bit more challenging, and I think the world would be in a slightly different place today.
Absolutely, and I think we probably all learned quite a lot about the pharmaceutical industry as a result of COVID. And in some ways, I think that's a positive thing because actually a lot of the practices in public were very much, you know, advertised on mainstream television. So yes, I think that probably really has helped to raise awareness of how research and development works.
And I think it also helps that the industry has a better profile now. When I was working in the multinationals, we were always a little frustrated because I think we were the second most hated industry when you asked public opinion because people saw these companies making very high profits. But of course, the high profits were because of the risk profile that I described earlier. So unless people really understand that and know, you know, what sort of risks are being taken, it's very difficult to understand why investors expect such a high return from their pharmaceutical stock. But that's the cost of doing business in that industry and taking that long-term high-risk approach to developing new medicines.
Clearly, what's important to any company is the saleability of their product at the end. And there's no real point in developing something that's not going to be picked up or utilised. So how does the pharmaceutical industry assess, you know, effectiveness, but also the person who's going to use it, the user-friendliness of that product equally going forwards?
Right. Well, those are very important points that have to be addressed very early on. And you can imagine this is, you know, 10 years, a decade before the product's actually going to be used. You've got to try to understand and think about what might be happening in that field in 10 years' time. So you don't need to just understand the disease and how the disease progresses, but also how the rest of the industry is developing technology and other things to try to help and deal with those conditions. When you start a project like a new chemical entity development, you would always have what's called a target product profile, a TPP. So that's kind of the language in pharma. And there you would work with patient groups around the world trying to understand, you know, what needs to be delivered. So what is the current standard of care offering? And you would always try to develop what is described as first-in-class and best-in-class treatments, because that's where you would be rewarded with the innovation, with the best price for your new product when it comes to market. Now, of course, again, a lot can happen in the 10 years, but you do have a good idea of what your competition is doing during that time in the sector. So you can also keep an eye on what's going on there. But a lot of the initial profile will be developed in consultation with the healthcare professionals, the specialists in that area. There would often be what's called an advisory board of experts. Usually the top experts from around the world will support and help companies in developing those target product profiles. And then, of course, they would be part of these external steering committees to make sure that everything was happening according to the protocols during the trial. But the other interesting factor, and it's becoming so important now, is, as you said, it's no good to develop something that's wonderful and great that will serve patients if the health systems can't afford it or are not willing to pay for it. So this whole area of what is called market access has become increasingly important and an area that pharmaceutical companies have had to become experts in. Because often when you design your clinical trials, you need to design trials that can then also justify why you're charging a specific price for that medication once it's launched to the public. Often you have to launch first without reimbursement from the healthcare systems or the health insurers in the US, that's very challenging. So you need to then work with the different authorities, and these are usually different to the regulatory authorities who approve the drug. These would be like NICE in the UK, which is looking at the effectiveness of the cost effectiveness of the product in those particular disease states. So there's a number of elements that you've got to build in at the very early stages of your research program to make sure that by the time you're ready to launch, you not just have the effectiveness or the safety profile, but also the affordability to the health system of the new drug that you've developed.
And I suppose equally input on the mode of delivery. So now we've got liquid preparations, we've got controlled release, we've got some that can be dissolved in water. I suppose there's all those various different preparation intakes, yeah, which maybe just require a slightly different science to allow it to, are these things dissolvable? Are they, right, you know, from that perspective? So there's all these different aspects to consider.
Yes, in fact, the galenic form, that whether it's a liquid, whether it's solid, whether it's injectable, we now have transdermal patches, of course, is another area that's been developed to try to ease the administration of the product. Most early phase products historically have been what we call small molecule products. So they can be put into a suspension and taken orally or injected, or into a tablet form and taken orally like that, or the medicine can then be put into a patch. Interestingly, the biggest shift in the pharmaceutical R&D world over the last, say, 5 years, I would say, has been the introduction of larger molecule products or biological products. And that's become the trend now, particularly in specialty pharmaceuticals. Most of the new products that are being launched are now biopharmaceutical products in the biological space. And that creates also challenges because most of those products have to be delivered by injection. They haven't been able yet to make that. Well, some of them are now becoming available in oral dose form, but they're still relatively new. And because of the size of the molecule, it makes it very difficult to put them into an oral or a liquid presentation that you can take physically without an injection. So, for example, Humira, which is a very large biological product, probably one of the most famous. I think its annual turnover is in the $17 to $20 billion per year. It's used now for several different indications because it actually has an impact on the immune system. So these products, but again, they have to be injected because they're large molecules and very difficult to make into an oral preparation, for example.
Wow, this is so fascinating. So it's not just even the development, but you could develop something that is effective, but then there's a whole heap of research that needs to go on top to perhaps make that in a user-friendly, consumable form. And that's not always possible based on the chemistry that I guess that's behind all the drug development.
Yes, that's right. And of course, for each of those forms, you have to do a new clinical trial with more patients, with more cost, because you want to, or the regulatory authorities will insist that you show that whether in oral form or injection form or in patch form, that you are getting the same effect, that the delivery system doesn't change the effectiveness of the drug or create other kinds of safety concerns. So every form has to have its own clinical trial program. And then, of course, you start only by getting usually registration in adults. And then you have to do a new clinical trial program for adolescents, mm-hmm, and then a new clinical trial program for children. And then the children can be split up into two different age groups. So again, you can see how the costs and the time can add up quite significantly through that whole process. And then you always have a risk of failure of the drug at any one of these stages. So it's a very, very high risk industry. And that's why the risk reward has to be fairly significant.
Wow.
I suppose with that then, if we were just to move away from that, is then sort of looking at drug repurposing. And I think a large number of people in the Parkinson's community are watching carefully because there's a number of trials happening where they're looking at different drugs that might be beneficial for people with Parkinson's. So what's your perspective coming from the pharma industry about repurposing of drugs?
Yeah. Well, I think there's two elements to that. So there's repurposing, so taking something that was meant for a different disease and seeing whether it works effectively for another disease state or set of symptoms. And it tends to be symptoms that we look at in the pharma world, not necessarily diseases as a whole. So we look more a little bit at the symptom space. That's different to biologicals, which is this, as I say, this new trend in the specialty pharma world. I have a little bit of experience with that at Sanofi. They had a very successful new biological product called Dupixent, which is now indicated, I think, in at least 6 or 7 different disease types, starting with atopic dermatitis, but also they're looking in different areas like asthma and others. Because again, some of the mechanisms of these diseases are very similar because it's an immune response from the body. And so that's, I think, where a lot of the research is being focused today, is they're looking at really why does the body produce these different disease states? And are these biologicals then going to be able to go across these multiple different conditions, different symptom states, and different disease states? So, for example, Dupixent, I think they've now been able to deliver at least 4 or 5 indications, many of them even down to children. I think the children's asthma indication in the US has just been approved. But that, again, at peak sales, estimated anywhere between $10 to $15 billion in terms of, so that makes it worthwhile to continue to look at all of these other different conditions that drug could be useful for. So again, it's, and again, you don't have to do all of that early stage research. It actually makes it much more effective for the company, because they are now doing just it's the big expensive end of the process that you have to do, but at least you know that the drug is working and is effective and is safe in large population size.
So I suppose it takes away those early risk-based studies and the fact that they do know it's effective, but then, right, as you say, they've still got the large trial to see whether it's effective in the given new population where they're repurposing it to.
That's right. And often that new population may be on a different cocktail of drugs already. And of course, it gets very complicated when you get into areas like oncology, into cancer research, because you have, what's called line 1 therapy, line 2 therapy, adjuvant therapy. There's all sorts of cocktails that are there. But the goal of the industry and all of the collaborating partners is always to try to drive higher efficiency, whether that be better symptom reduction, fewer side effects, or extension of life. Those are the kind of the main criteria that people look at. And of course, nobody's interested in paying for something that is just a me too or the same. So you want to have something that's actually going to have a significant benefit. Of course, there's lots of discussions, ethical discussions around, so what is, is 6 months extension of life of a cancer patient worth, spending another $5 billion on the health system? At a macro level, maybe you would say that's challenging, but at a personal level, of course, everybody would want to have that extra 6 months for yourself or for your loved one. So there's also quite a lot of ethical debate and discussion, and there's big ethics groups within each of the pharma companies who engage in some of that discussion with the health authorities and with the health systems in terms of whoever has to pay for that medication.
And I should imagine with a diverse condition such as Parkinson's, what people regard as beneficial or effective varies. So for some people, if they could just not have their tremor, they would be thrilled. And other people, perhaps having less fatigue or perhaps having an improvement in their mood. And so for different people, effectiveness means different things.
Absolutely right. And that's why it's very important. I think more and more pharmaceutical companies are doing this. They are reaching out to the patient groups to have that dialogue. Now, of course, they also have to be careful because their competitors are also doing the same. So, you know, it's a business, so they have to, you know, compete for their market share, their business. But again, the closer they can get to the patient, understand what's happening, they have ethnography research where they will actually go and spend time with patients, understand, you know, what challenges they face. The other area that's interesting that's starting to become more prevalent is not just looking at purely the chemical drug or how it's delivered, but also what you surround that drug with. They call it 360-degree drug development, and that's, for example, developing, you know, a coaching app that will go alongside your new drug, working with coaches for physical activity, which might help improve the outcome of a drug in a trial, for example. And of course, you've got a lot of digital therapeutics now that are being developed, which are just, you know, digital content that can be registered. And I think it's more in the mental health area right now, but it is starting to expand into other parts of research where these digital therapeutics can be used alongside, you know, actual chemical drugs to improve the outcomes that patients get. So again, it adds some complexity to the development process. And of course, that's something that's already long and expensive. So you don't want to make it overly complex. But I think there are definitely opportunities for more collaboration. I worked in the medical technology industry for a while, particularly in the diabetes space. And that was an industry that did really benefit from those types of collaborations, working closely with the pharma companies to develop new monitoring technology, new diagnostic testing, but also, you know, improving the application and the delivery of the drug itself into the patients.
Like, that is just music to my ears, I have to say, because something I've always thought, being a physio and somebody who's very interested in physical activity, if you give people drugs that perhaps maybe lessen their tremor or relieve some of their bradykinesia, which may enable them to move more easy, if they've been maybe sedentary as a result of severe symptoms for a while and you give them medication that improves it, it's the medication only takes them some way. You need then something to support that behavioural change, to change a habit. And that the medication's not designed to do that. And I've often wondered whether, you know, pharmaceutical trials would have a better outcome if the drug was delivered in parallel with education, advice, guidance, appropriate healthcare professionals. So it's nice to see that the industry has gone from being very objective, pure quantitative, hardcore, number crunching data to perhaps acknowledging that these are tablets that people take and it needs to be put in a sort of a holistic prescription as well.
Yes, and I don't want to overplay it because, again, the industry is still fairly focused on its drug elements. And I don't know if you've noticed, but in the last few years, the big multinationals have tended to actually move to a more specialized view. So they've got rid of their consumer health businesses, their medical device businesses and others, some of the diagnostic businesses, to focus a bit more on pharma. But having said that, they're now much more open to collaborations and partnerships outside of their own companies. So I think they've realized that to fill these drug pipelines from just their own pure R&D effort is very, very difficult. So they do have to collaborate. In fact, I know there's one in the Parkinson's space with Pfizer working actually with a private equity company, Bain Capital, that has created Cerevel, which is a pharmaceutical company focused exclusively or almost exclusively on the Parkinson's space. So that's something that Pfizer realized that was an important area, but they didn't want to do it on their own because the risk return was quite high. But they were able to, through collaboration partners, create something that will hopefully bring, you know, some much needed new product development into the Parkinson's space.
So that kind of segues lovely onto to one of my last few questions here. So thinking of where the pharmaceutical industry then, where do you see it heading then in the next sort of 10, 15 years? Do you think we're going to be seeing more of the use of AI, building in more technology? Where do you see the challenges, but also perhaps more importantly, the opportunities?
Yes. So I think it's you know, definitely an exciting time in the pharma industry, having come out of the pandemic. First of all, there is a silver lining to all of these things. So I'm always an optimist when I look at the world. And although it was a very difficult time globally, there's now been, obviously, the development of the vaccine happened very quickly. But a lot of these companies that developed a vaccine are now sitting on significant additional revenues that they weren't expecting to have at this point. And that will allow them to do some quite exciting new things, because a lot of that money will be ploughed back into research and development, perhaps in areas that might not have, you know, been ready for development if they didn't have the resources. So I know, for example, Pfizer was a very big beneficiary, having, you know, successfully brought out a vaccine early on in the process, and they're now starting to expand into new therapeutic areas, as I mentioned, including Parkinson's, through their collaborations. And a lot of that is helped by the kind of COVID windfall that they've had. So that's one area. I do think that you're going to start to see a lot more combination research projects happening with AI, with digital therapeutics, using big data analytics to drive, you know, and speed up the process. So hopefully we will start to see the collapsing of those timelines. So 10 to 12 years might get to 8 to 10 in the next couple of years through the use of AI in the early phases, and also hopefully making clinical trials a little bit easier and more efficient to run. Having said that, I do think there is going to be more consolidation in the pharmaceutical industry, and that historically has had a tendency to distract these bigger companies from the primary focus of the industry, which is getting new drugs onto the market. So I hope that that doesn't happen. I hope they've learned the lessons of the past. But I do feel that given the risk associated with this industry, that there will be some more consolidation happening where companies merge together. I know, for example, Pfizer just announced a $48 billion acquisition or merger just a few days ago. And I think we'll see more and more of that start to happen, particularly as the investment climate starts to improve. It's been a little bit slow over the last couple of years, but as things start to, you know, stabilize and inflation comes down, interest rates come down a little bit, I think you'll see a lot more mergers and acquisitions happening in the pharmaceutical space. But again, I think that's good, as long as it doesn't distract too much from the primary goal of the industry.
I would agree. I'm very much the glasses half full type person. And I think, you know, COVID was terrible on a number of levels. But actually, I think from a collaboration point of view, it showed that they, within the pharma industry, how they could actually collaborate rather than perhaps always being the focus being maybe perhaps more competitive from a financial point of view, and shared learning, as you say, big data projects. And so from that perspective, it shows it has been done, and perhaps that will be more fruitful for collaborations to happen in the future. So I see that as a really positive thing that perhaps could come out of the COVID pandemic.
No, I think it's absolutely right. And I think it also taught people that, you know, you don't always have to be physically present. You can do a lot with technology. And I hope that also drives in terms of the protocols for clinical trials, so to try to make those easier to run without compromising on safety. Of course, that's always the bottom line for the pharma industry and for the regulators. But I think there are definitely uses of technology that can help drive down costs, drive down the time taken to get to the endpoint that you need to, and adding these collaborations together and having a regulatory authority that is open to dialogue. And I think, again, the COVID pandemic exactly did that. The regulatory authorities had to be partners with the industry and with governments to ensure that they were able to fast track those vaccines to get to people, you know, as quickly as possible.
Wow, I have learned a huge amount this afternoon. That's been really, really interesting. And thank you very much for your time this afternoon.
Thank you.
Absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much. I could have listened to you all afternoon. Absolutely fascinating.